Well, welcome everybody to this event aimed at our new student arrivals. I'm Ian Begg, one of the teaching staff at the European Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome today Paul Thompson, who had a distinguished career at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, latterly doing some rather dangerous things to do with Greeks and Portuguese and Icelanders. Before the event starts, I would like to ask you to note the message from Polly in the chat function, saying we ask you if you wouldn't mind all to switch off your cameras and microphones. This is to make it easier just to keep order in the way the event runs. If you want to pose a question or make a comment, please do so in the Zoom group chat function, which will be monitored by both me and by Polly, who's running the event. The way we want to do it is I will start with at least a few questions, nothing provocative in the slightest, to Paul, in which we will try to elicit his views on a few things. There will then be an opportunity for me to put on behalf of the audience a number of questions. And I see we're now up to something of the order of 55 participants, so I can see that there's going to be plenty of scope for those students present to put their points. I may return to some further questions because there are one or two that Paul does know about and several more that he doesn't know about, so I'm going to try to trip him up, as you might expect. But to kick this off, let me start with a fairly straightforward question. Paul, you are now retired from the IMF, but you know Europe very well. Have, in your opinion, European governments and central banks reacted appropriately to the COVID-19 economic crisis, I underline economic, in the policies they've implemented?
Yeah, first, thanks for having me here. It's a great pleasure. I think that they have the response across all three major macroeconomic areas, fiscal, monetary, and financial regulatory has been very very large in terms of its scales and very swift. I think that's appropriate given sort of the exceptional situation and the significant front loading is certainly in line with the risks and the downside risks and the uncertainty. Conceptually, there were some questions, as you know, about in the face of what is in part a supply shock, does it make sense to have a significant demand stimulus? I think recent developments suggest that it does make sense. In any case, conceptually, I think the main point underlying the forceful policy response, from my point of view, is that it is critical in order to prevent sort of long-term scarring. You know, remember the global financial crisis, of course, was a financial crisis that spilled over into the real sector. Here's the other way around. We have a man-made real sector, and we are trying to prevent it from spilling over into balance sheet, into the financial sector, because we know this is when the long-time scaring comes through these massive support. And I think that is appropriate. I also think that the specific European response is appropriate. I think on the fiscal policy, I agree with the introduction of the recovery fund. With this significant element of north-south transfers and mutualization. We saw at the first few weeks of the pandemic, we saw some countries, I think like Spain, countries with limited fiscal space were struggling with their response because they were concerned that they didn't have the fiscal space to a forceful response. And I think it's entirely appropriate to provide European support, not for any other reason as a gesture of solidarity. The same with monetary policy. The ECB took the unprecedented step of deviating from the key, which means that it can go in its intervention and support the sovereign spreads of countries that are particularly vulnerable, like Italy. And that would have been highly controversial under normal circumstances, but I think in the situation it's recognized to be the right move.
Maybe, Paul, for those that are not macroeconomists, you could explain that last point just a little more. What do you mean by the spreads and the key?
Well, it's basically the Europeans have this idea that monetary policy needs to be, should not be allowed to monetize, to provide targeted support for specific countries, and it should be neutral in that sense. That interventions in the secondary bond market for sovereign paper should be done in line with the share of these countries in the ECB, what we call the capital key. But here it was recognized that there could be need for a disproportionate support for some countries, not least Italy. And to prevent a sell-off of Italian papers because of fear of debt sustainability, since Italy already have high debt, to prevent that from happening, and I think successfully so. So I think that's fine.
Is there anything you would criticize in what's been done? And I'm referring here to the short-term policy responses.
Yeah, I am concerned with fiscal policy. I am concerned that the fiscal policy response is not anchored in a medium-term macroeconomic framework, in a medium-term consideration. We have this exceptional, what is it, $12 trillion dollar expansion globally, and of its 10 is in advanced countries. And it's essentially arrived at by pulling out all plugs and then just adding it up. It's not being calibrated within a macroeconomic framework, in particular, what is justifiable from a debt sustainability point of view. And here comes my problem, that we are told not to worry about debt in this situation. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with the arguments that are being put forward for why we should not agree with debt. And this is particularly important now where we are facing a second wave and call for even further large-scale support. I think we need to be mindful of that there's a real bill to be paid tomorrow, and I would want that to be more in, get into the debate. I mean, I can explain why I don't agree with it, but that's the gist of it. We need more medium-term consideration and concern injected into the current fiscal policy debate.
Okay, I take your point. And some people may be thinking, once an IMF hardliner, always an IMF hardliner when it comes to fiscal policy. But we are, in one sense, in a war economy, are we not? In this case, the opponent in the war is the virus. Does this not justify exceptional measures and allowing debt to surge to unprecedented levels? Because let's face it, with interest rates at zero, what's the problem with debt?
So this is an exceptional circumstance and exceptional levels, exceptional reactions required. I agree. But you know, the approach we have now, it happens to add up to 10 trillion. But if it was adding up to 20 and 30 trillion, we would, under this approach, just nod our head and say yes. That is my problem. It is exceptional, but it is a burden on the future. So there is not this free lunch out there that we sort of seem to be relying on right now. I don't, there's one argument is, of course, that interest rates are very low. There's the whole debate about low real interest rates and low policy rates. So central banks governments can borrow for a long time without concern about debt sustainability. Well, the bad news is that they have already done so. Interest rates have been low for a long time. Real interest rates have been low for a long time. Policy rates have been low for a long time. And countries, not least the high debt countries in Europe, have been jacking up debt. So there might be a bit of a free lunch out there, but it has been eaten already, if you want to put it like that. I mean, think about it. Think about it. A country like France has seen a relentless increase in debt over the last three or four decades, from 20% to 100% of GDP. Debt has never gone down, never gone down. In the very good years, it's flat relative to GDP. In not so good years, it goes up a bit, and in bad years, go up fast. Now, if you tell French policymakers that because of low interest rate, the cliff is a little bit further off, Does that really change? That's good, to give you a bit more space, but it does not change the medium-term debate that you will be facing, you know, the medium-term issues you will be facing once the pandemic is over. Austerity will still be, you know, on the agenda when we come back with a vengeance, with a vengeance. And here my point is that we have been so bad at this fiscal adjustment, right? We do it in a gross unfriendly manner. We do it in a way that burden growth, and we do it in a way, not least, that that burden the young at the expense of you know, that burden the young by, because we want to protect the old. We do it in all these ways that are socially unfair and bad for growth. So, you know, when policymakers say to us right now, don't worry about that, we'll deal with that tomorrow. We will we'll deal, but we have been so bad at dealing with it. And when they throw in that, oh, we will have higher taxes, we will tax the rich, I'm all for it. But experience have shown that we are spectacularly bad at taxing the well-off. So it is, I think one should give, yes, exceptional situation require exceptional response, but that does not mean that you blindly just accommodate whatever it's out there.
Some of us of a certain age might think leaving the burden for the next generation sounds like a good idea, but one of the things that does come up in this crisis is that there has been very targeted spending in some respects through the rescue packages, particularly in the labour market. It was the Danes who invented something called flexicurity, which is the idea that you bring together flexibility in the labour market, but support for the worker, security for the worker. Do you think the policies that so many countries have adopted of trying to shield those in the labour market have been appropriate?
I think generally, yes. I think generally the policy of supporting people through existing social security or new schemes, I am fine with that. I'm much more worried about some of, you know, we are entering into a new area in terms of corporate welfare and support of businesses. I'm not saying one should not, but this is where I would have more reservation, given my concern about that. I know who's going to pay for this is socially vulnerable. If I look back in the past, I would be very cautious about just prescribing all this corporate welfare. I think we need to, you know, in industries where there is easy entry and easy access, I think we should start there and not provide generous assistance. But this differs from country to country, so it's difficult to have a view on.
I'm not yet seeing any questions from the audience. I therefore encourage anybody, particularly our new students, to come up with some questions as soon as you wish. But in the meantime, Paul, I take your point about the medium-term fiscal risks. Are there other sorts of risks that we need to consider in the medium term, as opposed to the short-term policies which you've generally given a vote of confidence in?
Well, I mean, I think what one needs to be careful about is that we do not forget that the underlying problems, the deep underlying structural problems, and the lack of coherence inside the euro area are still there. And I am really concerned that this shock will increase fragmentation inside the euro area over the medium term. It is increased north-south fragmentation and sort of pose a challenge to the euro area down the road. There's already signs now that the north will recover faster than the south. The south have more inflexible economies, inflexible labor market, and who are burdened by debt and therefore have less fiscal space. From that point of view, of course, the pandemic recovery fund is a much welcome thing. It provides us a counter-cyclical fiscal capacity that we didn't have last time around. But I am concerned a bit that it's being sort of described as a panacea. It is, of course, it will help a country like Italy. Debt will be lower and GDP will be a bit higher than it would be if we did not have it. But at some stage, it will stop. It will not become permanent. I don't believe in that. So, you know, you will have a drag on growth once you go the other way. And it will only work if, in the meantime, you catalyze, this support catalyzes greater willingness to do reforms in, let's say, Italy and other high debt countries. And here my concern is that is being overlooked. And my concern is that there's a lot of statements about there will be all these changes, but our experience with reforms that are sort of induced from outside is really bad. I mean, look at the Troika that I was a part of. We were good at doing austerity, but we were miserable at catalyzing deeper structural reforms. The Commission does not have a good track record in catalyzing and encouraging reforms. It's in line with the experience I have had from the IMF for 40 years. You cannot impose structural reforms from outside. They have to come from inside. Not the same as say that reforms will not happen in Europe. You know, Germany, we saw it, and now hopefully we're seeing it in France now. But I think it's an illusion to think that this recovery fund in itself will sort of catalyze a greater willingness to reform. There are those who believe, on the contrary, it will, all these issues about moral hazard, that it would actually delay the incentive of to reform. And I think it's an issue one need to be careful with that argument. Nobody going to mess up their economy in order to get support from Frankfurt or Brussels. But the fact is that since the European crisis in 2012, we have seen no reforms. The fact is that, let's say Italy, that did good reforms in 2012, as soon as the crisis was over, they gradually undid these reforms. And basically all the monetary reforms are undone by now. The same in Greece, some of the good structural reforms were undone. Europe has a problem of dealing with the structural reforms that are underlying the differences inside the Eurozone, and the problem of the Eurozone. And I am not that optimistic about that this, what's going on right now, would help in overcoming these issues.
Right. But there's a big but here. And here I'm going to paraphrase what my colleague Paul de Grava sometimes says, which is, and he's not alone among academics in this, which he says that the benefits of structural reforms are at best exaggerated, and sometimes even damaging to countries which are trying to deal with a demand problem. How would you respond to Paul if he were to put that poll as opposed to pool, if he were to try to put that point to you?
I certainly would agree that structural reforms are often used as sort of, just do structural reforms and the problem is solved, and people underestimate the importance of reforms. But there are two major differences underlying that are a threat to the euro area. It's the productivity gap between, let's say, Italy and Germany, where we have opened up a 30% gap now, and it's a gap between, say, France and Germany on the role of the state, which means that debt is going up significantly in one and down in the others. You will need to deal with those. These are structural differences that cannot be sustained. So I do not want to belittle the problem that one faces in structural reforms, but I do think they are effective. I mean, it can be effective. Germany is an example of it. Germany is an example through structural reforms. It became in other northern countries. They basically forced a lot of the less productive people into the labor market through reforms. One can have a political view on whether it's right or wrong, but they certainly had an impact. I think the critical issue for me is not the need for reform. I think that is relatively well understood that we need some reform, like in Spain were really, they benefited from reforms and had a significant positive response to the reform. But it is, you know, what brings them about and what can we do? I think we can do very little. It has to come domestically.
Right. Well, you did use the word catalyze earlier. One of my younger academic colleagues, Angelo Martelli, has posed the question, should external institutions effectively intervene to replace the country's political process? And by that, I mean the likes of you in your previous IMF role or the European Commission dictating from above.
Definitely not. I think it's totally unacceptable. I mean, this is I completely would disagree with that. I mean, you could say that the Troika that I was part of before is a sort of, you know, in your face version of that, right? And it doesn't work. It does not work, and I think it's politically and morally wrong. But it does not work. It is but the problem remains that the fundamental problem is that we have a currency union that is not a political union. And you don't create a political union by putting bureaucrats in charge. I know.
Right. I'll come back to another question in a moment, but we have one here from one of the MSc students regarding Germany's furlough scheme, which everybody seems to agree was the gold standard. It's now been extended to 24 months. But what's your view on whether this is likely to lead to zombie firms kept alive by state aid, or whether the pandemic causes structural change in the economy, transforming the likes of travel agencies, which are now reliant on having the money from the government? Are these concerns or threats, risks for the economy?
I think they are risks. I mean, I know too little about the particular things to have views on any particular schemes. There is clearly a risk that one socialize existing losses. There is clearly a risk that one delay the necessary restructuring of activities that have not will not be viable in the new environment. I think it's again with my hat on as a former IMF official. One slice where I am particularly worried about is in the financial sector, where we know that Europe has had a more difficult time forcing the financial sector to recognize losses, much less successful than in the US, where they during the global financial crisis, after a few months, really forced banks to recapitalize. In Europe, it took a much longer time. I think it improved with the SSM, but the fact is that on the eve of this COVID crisis.
Let me just explain to those listening that SSM is the single supervisory mechanism.
Yeah, single supervisory mechanism. It's the ECB's regulatory arm, if you want to put, as opposed to this monetary policy arm. And it is, they have done well, particularly considering that they are a new institution. But the fact is that they're still struggling to be effective in the banks to force them to recognize losses. We have quite a few countries with exceptionally large non-performing loans going into this crisis, despite many years of good economic conditions before that. We still have far too many unprofitable banks in Europe. And here one needs to be careful. I think on the one hand, there is a case in this situation for regulatory forbearance. There is a case certainly a case for releasing what we call cyclical buffers that we build up as a cushion for the bad times. If not now, when should we use them? But I think one need to be careful, and I'm coming back to your question here, one need to be careful that the way we deal with it is not to sort of changing accounting standards, and we need to be very above board with this, because Europe has struggled to get a sort of a transparent and unified regulatory system, And I think there is a risk that in this situation that one lose some of the progress there. So this is the area where I have some experience. One need to be very careful that one doesn't do this in a way that allows banks to sort of just evergreen loans and socialize existing losses. And
let's turn to letters of the alphabet. We've heard a lot about the V-shaped recovery. That seems to have been quietly forgotten. We're now possibly, particularly in Europe, in a phase of W, where we go down, then up, then down again, and maybe up again. And as I'm sure you're aware, Rubini, one of those who claims that he actually predicted the financial crisis, has come up with the idea of a K-shaped recovery. Kevin Featherstone, one of the senior professors at the European Institute, poses this question: are we going to see inequalities amongst countries widening as a result of what's going on? And is there any way to mitigate it? In particular, I wonder if I can push you, Paul, to be indiscreet. Can we name names? Are there particular countries that you fear for in the evolution of the pandemic's economic effects?
Yeah, so I do think, as I said, I think the pandemic has at a great risk, I hope I'm wrong, but a great risk of increasing fragmentation. That's a nice word for inequalities among countries, north, south. It appears that the pandemic is asymmetric in the sense that it affects everybody, but it will actually have a more negative impact on some of the most vulnerable countries, depending on tourism with a higher degree of service sectors, many higher degree of small and medium-sized enterprises that are more vulnerable, like Italy and Spain. And notwithstanding this transfer that's entailed by the recovery fund, I think that these economies will struggle. Look, let me be a bit provocative, but it's actually not very
surely not.
It is given what I know about how I see the policies out there, how I see the risk, in particular, the risk that once the recovery starts getting underway, countries will find it very, very, very difficult not to spend at least some of what is a cyclical recovery in revenue on sort of permanent expenditures, and therefore have a structural relaxation in the recovery. We have seen that time and again, and I see that it's a big risk. Just a bit of that, and also a somewhat, but not dramatically, less optimistic assumption about this in next year. I think by the end of this, not by the end of next year, most projections stop in the end of next year, which I understand because of the uncertainty, but mine, once the output gaps are closed again, whenever that is, 3 or 4 or 5 years, I think essentially France and Spain would be in the situation, as far as debt is concerned, that Italy was before the crisis. I think Italy will be where Greece was before the crisis, and Greece will be even further off the chart. That in itself will cause a need for austerity and fiscal adjustment that I think will increase differences as far as GDP performance is concerned, and particularly given what I know, how bad countries are doing it in a growth-friendly manner. So that's one source of it.
Well, we have a question here from Matteo Orta, who, if I'm accurate, is probably Italian, which may motivate part of his question. He's starting on the MSc in Culture and Conflict in Global Europe. He says, in your opinion, what are the most urgent structural reforms Southern European countries should implement to avoid the fragmentation you've been talking about? Let's take Italy, perhaps, as the case.
You know, I think it deviates a lot from country to country. I think in Italy, the usual suspects in some ways. I think a priority for Italy should be labor market reforms, to get more flexibility into the labor market over time. And I'm not talking about, and clearly also pension reform. And that's going to be dramatically difficult, right? Italy struggled before the pandemic. Imagine now Italy has to do this in a situation where the old has suffered so terribly. It's going to be very, very difficult, right? It is. But let me, so I can give you a list. I think reforms of the insolvency and bankruptcy framework is another thing, on third thing I would put in Italy. But my main argument would be, it's not a question of doing all these things now. It's a question of taking some decisions and putting these things on the book in a very, very gradual manner, but to create credibility. It's a question of creating credibility. It's a question of not just pulling out all the blocks and say we won't do this, that, and the other. Do it in the context of a medium-term program that explains how you're going to want to tackle both your fiscal and, the more important, the broader structural reforms. I think that's the main thing.
That sounds suspiciously like Washington Consensus Revisited.
Well, I don't think that is entirely fair. I can assure you that I... on some of these issues, like taxes, the need for higher taxes, and also for social spending. I think I am the need for social spending. I'm not so sure that I'm very much in line with the Washington consensus. But look, we have been arguing for years about some critical structural reforms in a country like Italy. It's all about insiders versus outsiders. It's all about how the insiders protect themselves. They have the good pensions, they have the good jobs, and that the outsiders cannot get them. And creating fairness and a more dynamic economy has not changed. That's still the critical challenge. But nobody, we can see from, I mean, take a country like Spain. Spain started tackling these things, but it was on the margins. Nobody expected you sort of dramatically change everything in the midst of a crisis. But it is having a view on what to do in a medium-term context and demonstrating that there is some broad political consensus.
Well, my colleague, another senior colleague, Valtra Cherkov, wants to challenge you. She asks, is not the real problem that we could not use the last crisis to build back an oversized financial system that's now thriving on the back of the extraordinary monetary measures and will become a source of instability for indefinitely? We keep on blaming national economies, maybe also national politicians, for their failure to adjust. Isn't that blaming the victims rather than the criminals?
So I think there are several parts to this question. I would agree with that there is a fundamental problem with monetary policy. I would agree that one of the problems we have is that from crisis to crisis, we get more and more leverage. And in between these crises, we had a policy of whatever it takes, a policy that became print, print, print. And it's... And we are entering this crisis with exceptional indebtedness in many sectors. I think that's part of the problem. I definitely think it's part of the problem. I very much subscribe to all this research at the BIS that suggests that for the last 20, 30 years, we have gone to crisis in part because we resolved then one crisis by excessively lax financial policies and continue to do so in between crisis. So I am all for it. I think one of the problem is that there is some degree of market capture of central banks. I think this issue one need to think careful about. But that's a separate set of issues. That does not mean that there is not a need for domestic policymakers to undertake reform. I think essentially in the last 3 or 4 years before the crisis, we were in a situation where there was basically no reforms in euro area countries. There was no fiscal adjustment in the high debt countries, and there was just a call for we need action at the European level. That I disagree with. It's we need action at the European level, but I think the main action still is required at the national level, given that we're in a currency union that is not a political union.
Well, just on that, the EU, you could argue, has at least crossed a Rubicon, if not engaged in what some are calling a Hamiltonian moment, by agreeing to fund its recovery package by borrowing directly from the markets. And the repayment won't even start until 2028. Mm-hmm. Do you see this as a desirable development? Or is it one which simply takes pressure off national governments to do the kinds of changes you've been talking about?
Look, I see the recovery fund as a necessary response to an exceptional situation, as a necessary reflection of European solidarity. I see that. I do not see the recovery fund, as many wish, as this Hamiltonian movement on the way to an integrated Europe, because I don't see it doing anything to the underlying problem necessarily. I hope it will, but I'm afraid that it will not. And that then would mean that I could actually see that if in 3 or 4 or 5 years there's a sense that all this money was wasted, if there's a sense that corruption and whatever it is caused wasteful spending, I think this moment now could cause a backlash later and make it even more difficult to handle the next crisis. So we're certainly sending money across the Rubicon, but I don't know I don't see it as the Hamiltonian moment. I don't. I had one slide. Can you put that on?
Sure. But before I do that, while I'm doing that, let me pose a corollary question to this, which is we've heard a lot over the summer about the Frugal Four. The Danes like you, the Austrians, the Swedes and the Dutch, to which you could probably argue there is also Finland is part of that same camp. So do you think that those countries have been engaging in negative approaches to what should be done at European level? Or are their objections fully justified in the way you've been implying? And now I'll share your slide so you can start to answer this.
Okay, so this is the slide I wanted you to see. This shows the change in debt since the creation of the euro. You have at the the Frugal Four plus Germany to the left, and you see that the Frugal Four has actually, some of them have had a reduction in debt, largely unchanged, a bit of an increase in Austria, because by and large, during periods of strong expansion, this is the blue, they have offset the loss of policy space that they used to cushion during the not so good years. This is orange that shows the public debt change during periods of contractions when the output gap is below zero. Now look then at the high debt countries at the right. You see Greece has had during this period an increase in debt of 80%, Portugal of 60%, France of 40%, and Spain are around the same. Italy actually the less than the others because it was constrained already by the high debt. There are many reasons for this, and I do not want to simplify it. But you see, for instance, that both Greece, Portugal, France, and to a small extent Italy, have been not only counter-cyclical during the bad periods, but even during the recovery, they have relaxed fiscal policy. That's one. It's one of several reasons. This is fundamentally unsustainable. That is where the criticism of the Frugal Four come. Though that is not sustainable in the long run. It is It is just not sustainable. Right now, we react by transfers and mutualization because we have an exceptional crisis. But don't interpret that as a willingness to provide mutualization and transfer to continue this underlying picture. That I don't believe is politically viable.
We all remember the old line from Keynes, in the long run, you're all dead. But let me also throw at you something your former colleague at the IMF, Olivier Blanchard, wrote in his presidential address to the American Economic Association. He didn't quite say debt is good, but he implied it was not nearly as bad as we've been believing. Do you believe what Olivier said?
Well, I believe that there is a significant role for the public sector and public investments, and I think that if you are particularly in this situation, if you have debt level that is well below the sustainable the maximum levels as suggested by debt sustainability analysis, I think there's a strong case for higher spending, particularly on growth friendly measures. So I am all for that absolutely. But I come back to Olivier is French. What does it? No, I have been interacting with French policymakers, with the Trésor for a long time. The fact that we are now going to have an extended period of low policy rates, that's good. That gives them more space for sure. They should be less worried about where the cliff is. But the fact that the cliff is further away will not fundamentally change the challenges they face. It will not, in a country that is struggling unsuccessfully in getting a handle on the structural problems that's driving this increase in debt. It is not going to change fundamentally the challenges they face. It's certainly going to allow them to have a bit somewhat more expansionary policy right now, and that's good. That's required. But in 1 or 2 or 3 years, when you come back to Paris, I think that it will not fundamentally change the challenges facing French policymakers.
I want to move on next, Paul, to a couple of questions from students. At least I think they're both students. Both on industrial strategy, industrial policy. Pietro Candia, who's doing European international public policy, asks whether the pandemic will force countries to adopt strategies of reshoring. And if so, would this potentially benefit Southern Europe?
Of reinsuring?
Reshoring. The reverse of offshoring.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm far from being an expert on this, but I have seen it. I think most of the speculation has been that if there is this shortening of supply chains, that's what we're talking about, right? That it might benefit in particular Eastern and Central Europe, which benefited a lot of being linked into to the German supply chains, particularly in the auto sector. I don't know enough about industrial policy to re-speculate.
Well, there is a parallel question from Robert Robitu, who asks whether any such gains are more likely to go to Eastern Europe than to Southern Europe.
Yeah, I think it's my expectations would be that they probably more likely to go to Eastern Europe. This is where the existing supply chains are, and if there is a wish to bring a lot of the production home, I would think that it comes easier there. Particularly if at the same time people think like I do that there is a risk of increased fragmentation, that some of the problems that have been burdening countries like Italy in the past will remain if not be worse.
Now, I take take your point that industrial policy is not your area of specialization, but nevertheless, there's one further question from Adonis Karimintsos, who asks whether there could be a role for a common EU industrial policy, maybe even some notion of EU champions, like national champions. Do you think the exceptional circumstances of today would justify such an interventionist industrial policy?
Well, I do think in a world of America First and Donald Trump, I think it's we are seeing inevitably that there is more of a wish in Europe to have industrial policy. And as you know, the French and the Germans, they have some meeting of minds on this. So there clearly is a drive on for that. I have no religious objection to that. I don't. I could see the case, but I can also see the risk. I still believe that that a lot of economic activity is best left to the private sector, and I could see a risk coming from a small country that the champions that are selected are not necessarily what I am from a small country would think it should be the champions.
Yes, I think we're all aware of the dangers of governments trying to pick winners and not having a particularly successful track record on that. Just going back one step, I have a challenge to you here from Jonathan Pakroff regarding credibility, particularly of the Frugal Four. His assertion is that while they're talking about trying to economize, they're simultaneously taking money away from other European member states by offering tax incentives to big corporations if they choose to become registered in Frugal Four countries. And he says, especially the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Is this true, do you think?
Well, I definitely think that there is an issue of tax legislation and tax havens that should be dealt with. But I think that's independent of the other set of issues that we talked about. But
this is not about tax havens. This is about national policies. In this case, the Netherlands, a bit like Delaware in the US, which is trying hard to become the center for corporate headquarters and thus to gain the tax revenue from them.
Yeah, I think that's a problem, and I think this should be dealt with. But I don't see that as being an argument against the concerns that we talked about before, about, you know, the macroeconomic policy concerns, or the moral hazard risks, et cetera, et cetera. They are there. You don't justify one problem by pointing another to another one. So I think these are independent.
Okay, well, back on your own territory, I can see that students are already collaborating because I have a collective message from Kathy, Lucy, Mark, and Jakob. And they ask, in relation to the regulation of financial markets, or going back also to Valtrad's earlier question about badly regulated financial markets, whether completing the Banking and Capital Markets Union and will have a positive effect on the sustainability of public finances? Or are we betting too much on achieving banking and capital markets union?
No, I think that's, I actually think it should be a priority, because I think that many of the obstacles to capital markets or to a European capital market are really of a technical nature. It's not as political as when we get into fiscal union, and there is a, I mean there are powerful arguments. For instance, when we compare to the US, we know if there is a shock affecting a US state, we know that some 80% of that shock, it dissipated through capital markets to the rest of the US. In Europe, it's much less than 20%. So it would help the stability, it would help the Eurozone's stability to country-specific shocks if we have capital markets that could help dissipate these shocks. But I don't think, once again, it's not a panacea. Europe will, in my lifetime, and in, I think in the lifetime even of many of our young audience, will not get a US-type financial markets. There are some issues that are deeply rooted in the sort of in the legal culture of that are very different from country to country. You will always have less dependence on capital markets and more dependence on banking systems in Europe, with its prevalence of small and medium-sized enterprises that rely much more on banking than on capital market. But I do think, particularly given the low starting point, I think there could be a significant payoff, also in terms of the stability of the Eurozone, by focusing whatever limited political capital you have on trying to promote capital market integration. I would agree with that.
Right, well, let's move on to a further topic that you and I have discussed in previous meetings for the benefit of the audience. One of them was in snowy Budapest, where it was very cold, but a much more agreeable one was in sunny Dubrovnik, where we were the guests of the Croatian Central Bank. That was fun. And you remember our evening dinners.
Very fun, yeah.
In Dubrovnik, we heard a lot of discussion from some of the central bankers who were present about monetary policy. We know that the ECB has now initiated a review of monetary policy. What outcome would you like to see from that review?
I do think this review is overdue. I can tell you, perhaps it's easier to do it with an example. I'm among one of those that argued that the ECB should have tightened in 16, 17, definitely beginning of 18. I'm one of those who argued that the closure of the output gaps in most of Europe suggested that they should have gradually begun the tightening at that time. I know what the argument is. The argument is that inflation is still well below the target. Well, I would have accepted that there was less of a slower move to get it to 2%. Basically, what I'm saying is that I think we need not only to focus on inflation, but also on sort of the state of the economy. So I come to a dual objective, a bit like in the US, which, by the way, would have meant that in 11, 12, we would not have tightened monetary policy. We would have a much more looser policy coming out, because at that time, output gaps were such that we could have lived with a looser monetary policy than we had at that time. I do think one need to do so, but that is going to be controversial, right? Particularly if we are in a situation when coming out of this recovery that we will likely get to a situation where monetary condition in the euro areas at large suggest that we should tighten, but in a number of weaker countries with high debt, that will be a problem. So this is controversial.
Yes, but if you have a single currency, that's inevitable. So it's not something you can restructure monetary policy to cope with. But let me ask a couple of specific questions then about the potential review of monetary policy. And by the way, somebody with a distinctly Hungarian name, Arpad, has reminded me that Budapest is always pleasant, whatever the weather. Do you think that the ECB should be considering a different inflation target, or implicit inflation target? Strictly speaking, it's not an inflation targeting bank, but it's very close to it, with its idea that inflation should be close to but under 2%. Do you think it should adopt a different target?
You mean whether it should have a level and allow overshooting for a period? Is that the question?
Or a 3% implicit target, or a 4% implicit target, or something like that?
Monetary policy has been spectacularly unsuccessful in the way they have not met the inflation target for many, many years. And I think in this situation, standing up on a chair and screaming even louder, "No, we're not going to get to 2. We're going to get to 3." Given how inflation seemed to be stuck, I am not convinced that this is the right thing. And I'm not convinced it because of the political problem that would cause inside the Eurozone. Don't spend your limited political capital on fighting the Germans on inflation right now, when inflation is still well below your target. I think that would be very, very smart. I think on money. I think that this is a very personal view of it. We started thinking about it the last couple of years. I think that the political reality of central banking is bound to change. I think, you know, if we are in a situation where central banks are telling us we will have these elevated balance sheet of 10, 15 times to what they used to be for as far as the eyes can see, then I think policymakers, politicians will have a view on what should be on these balance sheets. And I think
so. Is that saying the independence of central banks should be challenged?
I think the whole issue of central bank independence is very much going to be on the table. And inside the euro area, with that's going to be a particularly poisonous debate. I think that the whole issue of income distribution, monetary policy. Central banks are busy saying that they have a positive impact on income distribution. I'm not convinced about that, particularly on wealth distribution. I think these issues are more and more on the table.
Well, there's another direction that monetary policy could go in, and I'd be intrigued to hear your views on this. It's well known that the Federal Reserve has what's known as the dual mandate. That is that it has to simultaneously target the inflation rate and the real economy as proxied by the unemployment rate. And in times of high unemployment, Fed policy is supposed to privilege reducing unemployment and have less of a concern about the inflation rate. We know this was roundly rejected when the euro was created. And there's some who even argue that although the Fed has a dual mandate, it really, in practice, has been an inflation targeter. And at the same time, there are those who say the European Central Bank has implicitly engaged in a dual mandate because it relaxes policies when there's high unemployment. But do you think a formal dual mandate will be any help?
I think, I could see that. I think it's very much in line with what I said before, that I think there needs to be more dependence in monetary policy on the state of the economy. That is sort of a more general way of saying yes to a dual mandate. I think, the interesting thing is, of course, that it was the German and wanting to replicate the Bundesbank's concern about inflation. And now a lot of the calls for also thinking about the state of the economy is actually coming from the north, because they are concerned with the instability risk of a monetary policy, loose monetary policy at this stage, where we are sort of still well away from inflation. I have sympathy for the argument. On the one hand, I agree with that it's better to have inflation at 2%. It's certainly an insurance policy against deflation to have more of this margin. Although I do think we are exaggerating the risk of deflation. I agree that would be desirable. But the fact is, in the world we have been in for the last 20 years, 30 years, with this always structural downward pressure on inflation coming from globalization, just insisting on getting to 2% at whatever cost, I think that might be an insurance policy that we can increasingly not afford because of this for the instability risk that it causes. Mm. So I think one needs to review that.
And presumably also financial stability risk.
Yes, absolutely. In particular, financial stability risk.
Right. Let me move on to a different theme. Ooh. You worked at the IMF for, what was it, close to 100 years, I think.
Yeah, 40 years, 30 years.
Culminating in the Greek bailout in your later years when you were the director for Europe. Now, here's a question that's bothered many people in Europe and maybe more so in other parts of the world. I know that European countries are members of the IMF and therefore have a right to its support. But Do you think the IMF should have been so heavily involved in the Eurozone crisis?
Well, you know, I think that the IMF needs to take the view that the European countries are members and they have the same right to use the IMF as anybody else. You know, the reality is that the IMF became involved. We like to say because we were smart and we knew about crisis management, but, you know, frankly, the Europeans learned pretty fast. They don't need us for our money because they can print them. They have the hard currency. I think the real issue, to be honest, was that a number of big northern countries did not trust the Commission and they wanted the IMF involved. That's why we were involved. From our point of view, there were obvious stability concerns at that stage. It was the first time we had a currency union of advanced countries with no firewalls, being close to default. So there was clearly a systemic reason for the IMF to be involved, not only think about Europe, but the global financial. This was 18 months after Lehman. The system was unstable. I think it's, there was very much a case for the IMF to be involved. All of that has changed. Europe has its own crisis management system now. It didn't have it at that time. It has the ESM. It has the ECB that now has policies for what to do in the case of crisis. It's part of the crisis management framework. And I think there's a much greater political willingness to rely on European institutions.
But was it not the case that the political explanation for the IMF involvement was one concern from Germany that if the IMF were not involved, then all the burden would fall on Germany? And maybe just a hint of a second political explanation that the then head of the IMF had aspirations to become the French president.
Well, this is getting very complex now.
I warned you.
I do think that the main issue was the trust issue. There was a sense that Brussels was politicizing the issues and that in the end, the IMF has a bigger capacity to take economic, if you want, technical decision that's robust to political interference. I think let's face it, that Greece, when the Greece crisis happened and everybody was shocked about here, we had a country that we thought it had 2 or 3% deficit and it was actually 15. That was as much as indictment of the European process and of Brussels' ability to monitor and enforce the Growth and Stability Pact in the eyes of Germany and others. So there was a sense of that the decisions had been excessively politicized. And I think that was the main reason why the IMF got involved. Now, in the meantime, of course, the IMF, after the systemic problems were under control, started to talk about that Greek debt was unsustainable. And that was not a popular message among some of the capitals that had pushed for the IMF involvement. And the IMF's robustness to political interference became a problem when Europe was pushing this notion that there's no debt problem and we don't need to take measures to deal with the debt problem, which the IMF didn't agree with, and we stayed out.
After the event, there were many who said that the policies adopted towards or indeed imposed on Greece were far too harsh and it created a downward spiral. Do you think there were mistakes made in Greece? And more specifically, Kevin Featherstone asks, what was the IMF's biggest mistake, if indeed you accept there were any, in Greece?
Well, I think that we overestimated the capacity for reforms and the impact of reforms. It comes back to the question you had to me before. We dramatically overestimated it. I have to admit myself. I spent 25 years before the European crisis dealing with Eastern Europe, and I was not particularly familiar with euro area problem, and it took me a while to realize. I mean, the decision to admit Greece to the Eurozone was a purely political decision, not grounded in any economic realities. And we should not be surprised when the Greek crisis erupted. It became a political crisis. With very little ability to sort of adopt the reforms that needed to be done, except what we always are good at is to force countries to live within their means to austerity. But I think we dramatically misread the political situation and the ability of the country to do reform. And by implication, we misread the debt servicing capacity. And for sure, I am less convinced about all this argument about austerity. I mean, we argue that one should go slower, and even slower than we did. But you know, when you wake up one morning when the music suddenly stops and you see that you have a fiscal deficit of 15% of GDP, believe me, you will have austerity, right? And if that fiscal deficit is driven with an 8-9% increase in pensions, and you are in a situation where you cannot inflate your pensions away because you are in a currency union, it's going to be painful. It's going to be really painful. And so I think I am less apologetic on what we did on the fiscal, although in retrospect I would have liked to go even slower that we did, and we were the one who argued to go slower, and we got our way by adding a few years to it, but one should probably have added more. But fiscal austerity was baked into the Greek program from the start, because of the sort of bizarrely high fiscal deficit and the way that has been reached.
But let's turn for a softer interlude into Central and Eastern Europe. You mentioned how long you'd spent working there, and I have a question from our Hungarian student again, which I'll come to in a moment. But before we do that, tell us what you remember, fondly or not, from your time working in all these Central and Eastern European countries.
I was sort of from the start there. I worked on Eastern Europe even before the wall came down from 87, and have actually been involved in most of these countries. I found that a very satisfying experience, because it's basically the area where the IMF today in the world probably is looked most well at, because we really got it right there together with others. Yeah, it took longer, but we were on the right side of the issues and the diagnosis was basically right. It was more complicated than we expected, but there is a feeling in there that there was a good engagement, and I'm really pleased to have been part of this generally. I have many fun moments that I will not talk in public about in the process, but I do think this is an area that is I would add to this, given that I am sometimes very critical of Europe. Europe has been spectacularly successful in Eastern Europe, right? Spectacularly successful. I think the IMF was on the right side of the issues. But Europe is much, much more important. These countries have basically seen the transformation on a scale that Korea and Japan had in the 60s and 70s. And Europe should be very pleased with what it has achieved in Eastern Europe.
So I can't tempt you to tell us any of your tales from your time in Moscow.
Well, it was a fun time. But let's leave it at that.
All right. Let me come to Arpad Shaboda's, if I pronounce this correctly, question. He says that the Hungarian central bank is thinking about introducing interest-free loans for housing, yet there's a relatively high inflation rate there. This would be unorthodox. What's your opinion on having interest-free loans at a time of high inflation, remembering that for the benefit of others, that Hungary has an independent monetary policy and central bank?
Right. It comes to the problem that I mentioned before. It's very much in line with what I mentioned before. If we are in a situation where central banks are telling us that we need this highly accommodative monetary policy, as far as the eye can see, that we have this huge balance sheet, as far as the eye can see, politicians will ask for things like that. I think that has been in the U.S. In the U.K. also, didn't Corbyn ask about that you subsidize social housing through the Bank of England? Or perhaps I'm wrong, but I think I saw something like that at some stage. Politicians will do that. And I think it is a real risk, and I am not surprised. I cannot speak on, I don't know enough about the situation in Hungary to have a judgment of this particular scheme or what the risk to inflation is in Hungary right now. But I do think that with the kind of monetary policy we have now, central banks cannot expect to just be left alone by the politicians.
Well, I suppose behind this question is whether, in view of very low interest rates, this is an unprecedented opportunity for very substantial investment funded at almost no cost.
Yeah, I can see the case. Now, it should be a fiscal decision, right? It should be done not by the central bank, and we would all like it to have done by the budget, and we would all like to have the separation that monetary authorities do not get into fiscal decision. In this case, subsidization of social housing, but I again, it's I'm in the process of moving to buying real estate in Europe, and I have been in a situation where all the real estate I'm looking at is owned by hedge fund and pension fund. So we have a monetary policy that sort of enables these large investment in big marketplaces into real estate markets in the major European city. I'm not surprised at all that there are proposals for the central banks should instead or also directly get involved in social housing. I can see the politics of that very easily.
Okay, well, we seem to have run out of enthusiasm for questions from our audience. I will therefore come back to the pandemic questions for two last questions, one of which is the second part of Arpad's previous one, where he asks, we talked very much about the risks of financial instability. Do you think that we can afford a second lockdown, even if it means having to tolerate the health consequences of it?
I think it's an excellent question. I don't know really how to answer. I can tell you, when I saw close up early on the destruction of wealth that's taking place under the lockdown, the disruption of economic activity, I realized early on, if there is a second wave, governments will have very little appetite for doing this the same again. So I think it will be really, really difficult. But you, and it will be costly. But you know, it's very, we're speculating, right? I mean, if we end up in a situation where the health systems get overwhelmed and where mortality rates go up again, we'll be forced to do so. But clearly, what I see from talking to policymakers is a dramatically less willingness to consider this across the board in all governments that I have dealt with.
Right. Well, one last question then. Do you have a crystal ball there in your office? Because I'd like you to peer into it. And let's say by 2030, 10 years from now, do you expect the EU to emerge stronger or weaker from the trauma of the pandemic?
I mean, there is this old saying that Europe is built in crisis. You are familiar with that. And this is certainly the mother of all crises. And there is a temptation to think that this would, you know, be a great step towards further integration. Let's come back to this Hamiltonian moment we talked about before. I explained to you why I have my doubts. I explained that if there is a continuation of the same policy that we saw between the global financial euro crisis and now, during the good years, if we during the recovery slip into the same policies again, I think that it will be a weaker Europe. And perhaps I should leave you with that thought that, you know, when we talk about a stronger Europe and integration, in particular, through policies to strengthen the euro, there's always this comparison of being like the US, having the same kind of process. That's why we talk about Hamiltonian moment. There are many differences. The US is a political union, Europe is not. Perhaps it will, there is a process of moving there. But one major, major difference is that not only do you have less transfers in Europe, in US, you don't have transfers on anywhere the scale that we saw in Greece and now in the pandemic recovery fund. Nowhere on the scale. There are transfers, but nowhere on that scale. But more important, the weak place spots in Europe are West Virginia, Mississippi, or whatever it is. So, few weak countries. In Europe, high debt Europe, very high debt Europe, is essentially as big as the triple A's. And in between, you have a group of countries like France with very high debt, not the highest, but still high debt, France and Belgium. Transfer union without dealing with the underlying problem is just not a possibility. You will see if you make the calculation that if you have a transfer union, that the debt of this middle group will start going up at a fairly fast clip. If you really have true neutralization. This all comes down to whether Europe is going to deal with the underlying structural problems of the Eurozone. The problem that is still today causing a record high number of Italians, for instance, to leave Italy. What is highest level in 50, 60 years of young Italians that leave, the same in Greece, because economies are fundamentally uncompetitive. And it is unsustainable if we don't deal with it. It's
I have one last question that sneaked in from Jonathan, who asked the earlier one about the Dutch approach to tax. And one further one has just come flashed on my screen, which I'll read in a moment. What Jonathan asks is a general question, I think, a question that can be generalized, which is whether there are different European policies that might improve matters. And he asks specifically about whether a common corporate tax would be a way forward for Europe. Do you have any view on that?
I would like to see that. I would very much like to see it. I don't think we will see it, because I know the tax structures are in certainly not in my lifetime, because the differences here are very, very huge. There are a lot of political sensitive issues in trying to harmonize a Europe, create a European tax base. I mean, think about it. That, you know, Europe has talked a lot about Ireland, the Apple problem. You know, even when Europe was providing large scale assistance to Ireland in the context of a program, there was no talk about trying to force some changes major changes in the corporate tax system. There might have been some. And I'm not passing judgment on whether this was right or wrong. I'm just saying this is so politically sensitive that I don't think it's happening. I think that harmonizing tax bases, harmonizing tax policies would be a great place to concentrate efforts for increased European integration.
An associated question from Kaspar Kaisers, who also asked an earlier question, is a sort of Thomas Piketty question. He makes the point that Piketty finds that rich individuals invest in real estate because it's safe. There's no need for them to take risks, and this distorts the capital market. Would you agree with higher taxes on the wealthy, or different sorts of incentives for the wealthy to invest in what you might call productive investment rather than simply passive investment like property?
I think there, generally, I do think that there is a strong case from an economic point of view, from a point of view of having a growth optimal fiscal policy mix, to shift taxation from labor to taxation on consumption and wealth and housing. I am all for that. So yes to that part of the question. I also think that there are a lot of things in the tax structure that distorts investment decisions, you know, like the tax deductibility in some jurisdictions of investment in housing. So I think there are definitely things one can do there too. It's I'm all for soaking the rich, but I have also known from a long experience in policy making that that's politics. It doesn't pay for the big public expenditures for the public sector reforms that we need. So politically, I have no problem with it. But let's not fool ourselves and think that will pay for the, you know, for a 30, 40, 50% increase in debt during the pandemic recovery. That we don't need to worry about that, because we will just go out and tax the rich afterwards.
Yes, I've always held the view that those who try to translate academic ideas into policy making should be obliged to go on a simple arithmetic course to understand how what comes from one source can be applied to another place, and to know that, as you say, taxing the rich may be a nice idea, but simply isn't going to be arithmetically enough.
That's right.
Well, with that, Paul, I will let you off the hook. You've been very, very helpful to us. You've been honest in your answers, and you've told us all kinds of interesting things, and I'm sure the audience has enjoyed it. Those of you maybe not so familiar with Zoom will see, if you click at the bottom of your screen, there's a little icon for reactions, one of which is to clap your hands. We can't do that physically, but we can at least use this icon to thank Paul very much for his rich answers to our questions and for giving us an entertaining hour and a half. Normally, Paul, we'd be going across the road from where my background to the George for a glass of beer. Sadly, we can't do that.
Well, I will. You are building up. I have building up my claims on you. It's. Let me just say. I very much enjoy it. I'm really very happy to be part of the European Institute now, and I would very much look forward to work with all of you, particularly on these issues, about European governance and central banking issues that I feel passionate about. So I hope
right. to talk well, to you. We look forward to welcoming you in due course physically at LSE now that you're a visiting professor, and hope that all these restrictions that Boris capriciously imposes on us will be eased sufficiently for me to honor the promise to buy you a beer. Paul Thompson, thank you very much. Thank you to Polly and her colleagues for organizing this. And Polly reminds us too that there'll be many more such events, which we hope those of you who have listened today will be able to join in. Thanks again.